you? Glad you could join us for our continuing journey through the House of Hammer. I'm Kev Moore, your guide for today, and luckily for you, I'm joined by podcast legend Adam Roach, legend in his own lunchtime, Ben Taylorson, and Smokey. Just Smokey. Like Cher, but less sunny. For any of you new visitors, or if you're just as forgetful as me, so far we've had Cat Horror on the High Seas, an East End sing-song night, and a tap dance-off. And that was just from the 30s. After all that, and in a little nod to what would eventually become Hammer's bread and butter, 1936's The Bank Messenger Mystery, the tale of a bent bank teller turned bank robber, was to be their last of the 30s, and another addition to the long list of lost films. These were crazy times, and with the perfect storm of an impending war, more second features than hours in a day, and not being able to crack that American market, it sadly saw the demise of the first incarnation of Hammer when they went into liquidation in 1937. Will Hammer was down, but by no means out. He'd already formed a partnership with Enrique Carreras at Exclusive years earlier, which had bought the leasehold to Wallace House at 113 Water Street, London. During the war years, that and running a theatrical management agency kept them busy. After World War II, Wallace would become Hammer House, as it started to find a new direction, leaning heavier into the darker side of things. The first of a few co-productions between Hammer, Knightsbridge and Marylebone Studios, 1947's Crime Reporter, sees a chap tracking down the murderer of a taxi driver to a dingy club in Soho, where he unmasks the killer as the leader of a gang of black marketeers. This would have been the subject of this episode, had it still been available, but unfortunately, it's yet another one that's forever lost. Instead, we're supposedly going uptown to Bond Street, which turns out to be every bit as killy. The glamorous world of high fashion is literally murder, but who did it, and do we care? Here to talk about a what did it or something is Ben.
Okay, so I'm going to provide you with the briefest of brief histories of the whodunit. But before I take you on that whistle stop tour, I need to get something out of the way. Me and the whodunit, we don't get on. Why? Well, it's quite simple, really. I can never, ever work out who did it. Frankly, sometimes I'm just lucky enough to work out what it was they did. I put the whodunit in the same bracket as the cryptic crossword, in so much that I can't do it and thus it's stupid. Ordinary crosswords? Fine. You either know it or you don't. Here's a scenario. I'm on the train with a newspaper and I turn to the ordinary straightforward crossword. I take a glance at the clues. Two down, capital of Belize, 8 letters. And I think, nope, I've no idea what that is. And that's not a problem. I can either cheat and look it up on my phone, or, more likely, I can fold the newspaper up and calmly place it on the seat beside me. But when you open up the newspaper at the cryptic crossword, it's all one across, Scottish lake dweller scorns helmet on manoeuvre. 10 across, vegetable may make comeback. 6 down, dilapidated sheep leg iron. Utter meaningless nonsense. Gibberish. And I find myself tearing the newspaper apart, hurling it out of the window of a moving train, whilst tears of anger stream down my face. You know, I was once on a train in the midst of a mid-cryptic crossword breakdown, when the guy opposite me leaned in, pointed to 4 down or whatever it was, and told me, that's an anagram, you can tell by the way the clue is written. He was just trying to help, but frankly I felt the overwhelming urge to roll the newspaper up and hit him with it until the British Transport Police arrived. Anyway, back to the whodunit. Like the cryptic crossword, the clues may be there to indicate who did what to whom and why, but by the time the big reveal comes, I'm usually a weeping ball of frustration, my metaphorical newspaper long since hurled out of the window and residing in the power lines above the East Coast main line. And all because I hadn't worked out that it was the victim's second cousin who murdered them owing to crippling death stroke, jealousy stroke, insanity stroke, vegetables making a comeback or whatever. So, now we've got that out the way, I think we can all agree that I'm the perfect man to talk you briefly through the origin of the whodunit. The word whodunit is a colloquial elision of who has done it, and is typically a complex plot-driven variety of detective story in which the puzzle regarding who committed the crime is the main focus. The reader, or indeed viewer, will be provided with the clues from which the identity of the perpetrator may be deduced before the story provides the revelation itself at the climax. The investigation is usually conducted by an eccentric amateur or semi-professional detective, and the narrative development can be seen as a form of comedy, in which order is restored to a threatened social calm. Or, let's put it more simply, The Whodunit is a story about a murder, where the identity of the murderer is not revealed until the end. It's widely agreed that the origins of The Whodunit date back to the mid-1800s. Specifically, Edgar Allan Poe's short story, The Murders of Rue Morgue, first published in Graham's Magazine in 1841. The story tells of a brutal murder of two women in Paris, a mystery ultimately solved by amateur detective C. Auguste Dupin, when it is ultimately revealed that the murderer was, spoilers, an orangutan with a straight razor. I think even I would be forgiven for not seeing that one coming. Dupin displays many traits which will become the literary conventions in subsequent fictional detectives, and it also begins the theme of brains over brawn, which feature in stories where the analytical skills of the detective, regardless of their physicality, ultimately prove to be the undoing of the violent aggressor. A couple of decades after The Murders of Rue Morgue came the first detective novel. The Moonstone by Wilkie Collins was published in 1868 and serialised in the Charles Dickens magazine All the Year Round. It's the story of a theft of a significant precious stone, the titular Moonstone in fact, and the efforts to find the thief and relocate it. Without having read it, I can confirm with almost 100% certainty that the thief was not an orangutan with a straight razor. Throughout the 19th century, mystery and suspense stories continued to gain popularity, with perhaps the most famous fictional detective of them all, Sherlock Holmes, first appearing in print in 1887. By the 1920s and 30s, the golden age of mystery fiction was well underway. Between the First and Second World Wars, Agatha Christie introduced the world to Hercule Poirot and Miss Marple. Dorothy L. Sayers began penning the adventures of Lord Peter Wimsey, and John Dixon Carr created Dr. Gideon Fell and Sir Henry Merivale. The term The Whodunit was reputedly coined by News of Books reviewer Donald Gordon in 1930 when reviewing the detective novel Half-Mast Murder by Millward Kennedy. However, several other journalists subsequently claimed that the term was dreamt up by them. Regardless of who thought it up, by the time Death in High Heels was released in 1947, The Whodunit had firmly spread from page to screen. The 1930s had already seen six Perry Mason movies by Warner Brothers. Fox had produced a series of films around the Japanese sleuth Mr. Moto, and MGM had the Thin Man series. But by the 1940s, things were beginning to change. The 1930s had been the era of the elegant gentleman detective. Most were quirky amateur sleuths who solved crimes for their own amusement. They carried no weapons, and they often had eccentric personality traits. During the 1940s, this type of crime fighter fell out of fashion. Instead, a new breed of tough, hard-boiled, no-nonsense professional detectives began to emerge. As has been the case already with some of the previous Hammer films we've looked at, Death in High Heels seems caught in this transitional phase between the two. Since its golden age on film, the whodunit, like every enduring genre, has adapted over the decades, merging in fact with other genres. In its purest form, the whodunit has found its home on the small screen. I'd cite series such as Morse, Poirot, Sherlock, Miss Marple, Broadchurch, Veronica Mars and Twin Peaks as just a few of the many examples. Big screen whodunits still appear regularly, but with a tendency to be merged with other genres. Take, for example, when the slasher movie had their own golden age in the 1980s and 90s. A common ploy, indeed almost a genre staple, was to hold the identity of the murderer from the viewer until the big reveal. It's interesting to consider that in comparison to the early days of the whodunit. Consider also movies such as Seven, Gone Girl, Mystic River, The Usual Suspects and countless others to see how elements of the whodunit are now firmly embedded in narratives beyond the narrow confines of the drawing room murder mystery. All of that said, if we look back at the subject of our first episode, 1935's Mystery on the Mary Celeste, the hybridisation of the whodunit with other genres has been happening on screen for a long time. I guess the truth is, people just love a mystery, and a chance to solve it. Or indeed, not to be able to solve it and get angry about it. Stupid films. Stupid crosswords.
Being the practical sort, I generally tend to stick to reading instruction manuals in the belief that if a book is good enough, a film will be made of it eventually. And with the few writers that Ben's already mentioned, Death in High Heels is also based on a novel. It was written by Christiana Brand in 1941, and apparently she's well known, and luckily for me, Smokey has something to say about her.
Whilst not strictly a Hammer hero, it would be severely remiss of us if we didn't make mention of Christiana Brand.
Mm-hmm.
not least for the fact that her debut novel, Death in High Heels, which is obviously the source material for the film we are focusing on, but also that she wrote her novel after daydreaming about how to get away with dispatching of a colleague and not being caught. And trust me, after 4 episodes of god-awful smoky puns, one's mind does tend to wander somewhat. But let's not get bogged down on how, possibly, a podcaster from Teesside disappears while they're out jogging, how, maybe, a physical media salesman from Doncaster gets buried under a pile of unwanted War of the Worlds DVDs, or, and just for instance, a voiceover artist slash chef gets gnawed on by a dog called Boris. No, instead we are going to put all, or at least most, of our focus on the writer of this particular whodunit. I will admit straight from the off, before we started this episode, my knowledge of Christiana Brand was literally non-existent. Call me uncultured if you wish, and I'm sure you will, but my literary history has just never happened to cross paths with hers. However, this is one of the beauties of the show, for me, well, and hopefully for you as well. Once you start diving into people's lives, it can become fascinating and take you on a journey that you didn't even know was there. Honestly though, to go through every piece of literature that Christiana wrote and produced, it would take longer than all of our episodes so far. Also, after learning how well known and regarded Ms. Brand was, my short synopsis will never compare to what ardent fans will know about her life and her novels. So, we may as well stick to the basics, and for those of you who were or are in the same boat as me, we can all learn together. Christiana Brand was born Mary Christiana Milne in 1907 in British Malaya and lived there until she returned to England to attend a Franciscan convent school in Somerset. Unfortunately, around this time, her father lost all of their money and she left school at the age of 17 to work at a series of low-paying jobs which included governess, salesgirl, dresspacker, ballroom dancer and model. While in the salesgirl profession, the idea for Death in High Heels occurred to her. However, before completing the novel, she fell in love and married the noted surgeon, Roland Lewis, in 1939. The book, once completed, was rejected by 15 publishers, but was accepted without a single revision by the 16th, and it was published in 1941 and received great critical acclaim. Also in 1941, one of her best-loved characters, Inspector Cockerell, of the Kent County Police, made his debut in the book Heads You Lose. Miss Brand is said to be noted for her clever plotting, her ability to surprise the reader, and for a good sense of humour. The novel Green for Danger, written in 1944, is considered her most outstanding work, and is a classic of mystery fiction. In the book, a patient in a hospital for bombing victims dies on the operating table. Foul play is detected in the death, and Inspector Cockerell is called in to investigate. Christiana had a first-hand knowledge of the war and of hospitals during this period. Her husband, Roland, volunteered for the armed forces and was posted to a hospital in Kent, while she joined the voluntary aid detachment at the hospital and became quite familiar with the nighttime bombing raids. Her time spent also included working in the emergency bed service, which was a government bureau that got patients assigned to the nearest possible hospital in the shortest period of time. Green for Danger was adapted for film by Eagle Lion Films in 1946 and starred Alistair Sim as the inspector. The series was dropped in the late 1950s, while Christiana concentrated on various other genres as well as short stories. She was nominated 3 times for the Edgar Awards, the annual awards for mystery fiction and amongst other genres, for the short stories Poison in the Cup and Twist with Twist, and for a non-fiction work about a Scottish murder case, Heaven Knows Who, in 1960. It is, of course, also worth noting that she is the author of the children's series of Nurse Matilda, which Dame Emma Thompson adapted into the Nanny McPhee films in 2005 and 2010. According to reports, Christiana passed away in her husband's arms on March 11th of 1988. They had been married for 50 years. As previously mentioned, my knowledge of Christiana Brand was scant, to say the least, but sometimes just a little bit of trivia or knowledge about a person can just set you off, and you find yourself transfixed by a person's achievements. And that's exactly what's happened here. But, as I am wont to do, I like to leave the final words to people who are far more intelligent and verbose than I am to sum up some of the industry greats that we stumble across while making this show. Noted American author Anthony Boucher is quoted saying, "You have to reach for the greatest of names, Agatha Christie, John Dixon, Ellery Queen, to find Christiana Brand's rivals in the subtleties of the trade." End quote. I can't, and I won't put it better myself. Oh, and Smocrates... pink but beige. Oh, that's coming back to haunt.
Come back to haunt you? You'd better believe it. Anyway, you know how I mentioned earlier that before the war there were too many films being released? Well, this is where it could seem a little awkward. After the war, the cinema was definitely the place to be, and 1946 saw a staggering all-time peak attendance, due mainly to the lack of rival activities. Throw in a tax dispute in 1947 for good measure that saw Hollywood withhold any new releases for 9 months. Yeah, 9 months! And suddenly, the appetite for homegrown films had never been as voracious. Because after all, Britain now had 4,700 hungry picture houses to feed. Little studios with questionable standards were churning out as many B-features and quota quickies as they could. One of these was Marylebone Studios, a small studio with 2 sound stages in a converted church hall near Edgware Road in London. Owned by Henry Halstead, Marylebone had a modest success with a potted version of Othello that had a 45-minute runtime. This led to many short films over the next few years, and would bag them an Oscar for Jack Cardiff's 1956 chiller, The Bespoke Overcoat. Unfortunately, an Oscar isn't enough to pay the bills, and the company folded only a handful of films later. What has this got to do with Hammer? Hang on, we're getting there. Jack Goodlett, the bookings manager of the mighty ABC circuit, and longtime friend of the Carreras family, suggested the possibility of the revival of Hammer during that crazy summer of 1946. This selfish request had been prompted by the shortage of product, and with co-funding from the short-lived Knightsbridge Films and the aforementioned Marylebone Studios, it wasn't long before the name Hammer was back on the big screens around the country. This blending of the strengths saw the production of River Patrol. The rather ostentatiously titled Dr. Morell, The Case of the Missing Heiress, the more simply titled Celia, The Man in Black, and 3 Dick Barton movies. Co-production certainly was key to the success of Hammer, and over the years, the company would have some of the biggest bedfellows in the business. But that's a story we can save for another day. So, on to the first fruits of this particular partnership. Filmed over a 4-week period in January, Death in High Heels was released in the UK by Exclusive on the 18th of July, 1947. There's a murder at a London fashion house, and all the employees are suspected of a poisoning, which has seemingly been administered to the wrong person. The characters include a number of haughty models with cut glass accents, a flamboyant designer who's always threatening suicide, a Cockney char lady, and a Chinese girl who describes herself as inscrutable. Here's Detective Charlesworth, the slickest crime fighter on the block, to be equally unhelpful.
The whole thing seemed to revolve about this chap Bevin. He was the owner of the dress shop Christoph's in Regent Street. The rest of them were working there. There was this girl. Something or other Gregory, her name was. She nursed a secret passion for Bevan. At least, not very secret. And then there was... Well, let's take Victoria. Don't look now, but I think Victoria has something to hide. Then there was a Chinese girl, Miss Almond Blossom. Bevan had taken a fancy to her and given her a job in the shop. She was a great success in the shop. And Aileen, one of the models. Aileen had a very grand young man, and she was very anxious to be grand herself. Oh, and this is Mrs. Harris, the charlady at Christoph's. Mrs. Harris also has something to hide. And here is Mr. Cecil. Mr. Cecil's the dress designer, and about once a week he announces his intention of committing suicide, and never does. And finally, Miss Doone. Gregory, that was the first girl we saw, was Bevin's right hand. Well, Doone was his left. And Bevan had a sticky time trying not to let his right hand know what his left was doing.
I arrived rather late, and I had Miss Gregory with me.
So, Death in High Heels then. Wikipedia simply says the police are called in when a woman is murdered at a luxury Bond Street shop. Luxury Bond
luxury.
Street shop.
Luxury.
I know, they can't even get that
it's
right.
It's a shed with a curtain.
Yeah, or the back end of a circus caravan.
Ugh.
I
yeah, it's not. It doesn't scream the height of luxury, though, does it?
It looks like the kind of clothes shop I would go to, which is nowhere near fashion.
It looks like the kind of shop that Smokey would shop at.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. But, well, you know, it's run by three moderately attractive women. Yeah, I'd spend a lot of my time there. Yeah, that's fine. I wouldn't buy any clothes, but
it does.
You know.
It looks like the back room at an Oxfam. It really does. It's just a table
on a bad day.
In a room with a doorway and a curtain.
Yeah, and a mirror.
You can't forget the mirror.
Although there is a like one of those moments where they do like a fashion show, you know, and it's like a fashion montage, and it's basically, you know, just the Nolan Mills set, and the girls walk on, you know, in a different dress and go. And then walk off, and then they walk on again, and they go. And then they walk off again. Yeah, for those people who can't see that, I'm being very sexy right now. Go on.
Absolutely. No, it reminds me of the opening of Camberwick Green.
Yeah.
But did you know? I mean, all they do is stand on a revolving floor while modelling whatever dress they're wearing, and they just looked so awkward. They didn't look like they were having fun at all. Mm.
Models were a lot lazier in those days.
I think we can all accept that whoever was the production designer on Death in High Heels from 1947 had never been to a shop, let alone a fashion shop, in their lives. Didn't you went to a fashion shop? What's that? It's like an Oxfam, yeah. Who has a... as well, when they have lunch... I didn't know this was a thing, but halfway through the film, everyone goes into the basement and they cook a chicken curry / a rabbit curry, don't they? Just one of the shop people just stands there and cooks this. Is it curry? Yeah, it's curry, right? Curry. They all sit around a table and have this meal. It's like, when did that stop being a thing? Because, I mean, I've worked in a few shops. And basically what you do is you like lean into a corner and you like eat whatever, you know, bag of crisps or something you've bought. You know, have like one of your workers go, "All right, it's my turn today," and they go off and they like, you know, saute the onions, put a bit of garlic and ginger in there. So it's like, when did that stop being a thing? See, the good old days.
Funnily enough, it was just after this film was released because everybody thought, right, no more. We're not having Mr. Cecil make our curry.
I wonder why.
Yeah, I was going to say, to be fair, it does kill someone.
Yeah.
So, you know, they probably thought it was a good idea to knock that on the head before it got any worse.
You need to stop this trend. You can all have a pret-a-manger. That's what you The rise
what
of
a fantastic adults. Murder weapon.
Yeah. But I think you've got to say, though, right from the very off, I mean, I know there was quite a big gap in between Sporting Love and this, in terms of time, I mean. But yeah. Straight away, just from the... I know it's going to sound a bit naff, but just from the quality of the credits, you can tell we're stepping up in quality. And
definitely.
Well, at least I think we are.
Jesus.
What? I was just saying. It doesn't look shoddy.
Right.
Yeah, no? Unfortunately, okay. It's filmed in a church. So,
well,
I think
it takes a dive.
Compared to the lovely films we've seen so far, maybe. But I mean, as someone who spends so much time in this era, the first thing I thought when I saw the credits come up was, Jesus, it's like someone's just, you know, like you have them storybook credits, you know, when someone opens a book and you like turn a page and then you read the names and then someone magically turns the page again. Like, these are half decent, you know, and then you get like, credits like in the Fred and Ginger film Carefree, where you get this pane of glass and it's like got this oil on it, and these fingers just come on and they rub into it like this, and they go woof, and all the credits are on there, and then they mess it all up again and write the credits in the oil. It's like you watch it and you go, this is way better than the film. Like in Death in High Heels, it's like someone just went sh-sh-sh-sh-sh-sh on a bit of cardboard. There you go.
All I'm saying is that compared to the previous three, this is a step up. That's all I'm saying.
Okay. I agree a step up from Sporting Love.
Dysentery is a step up from Sporting Love.
Leprosy is a step
Rabbit
up.
Rabbit curry is.
I have to say, I had real problems with the Sporting Love font on the credits. I really didn't like it. Something about it, and it's the screen I get on my media server when I flick past it as well. I hate it. That's a fascinating fact for you all.
I did like the opening, actually, the way that they've got it structured so that you've got Charlesworth straight away. You know, he walks out with the newspaper and you see that him solving the crime straight away. So then he kind of does this, and this is what happened, and tells you the cast of characters and stuff like that. And you think,
yeah, I really
that's
like
actually
that bit.
Quite clever.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah. Mm. Quite clever as well, because Charlesworth, even though he's the lead, apart from this bit, you don't see him for a good half the film. I think it's about 18 minutes into a 46-minute film, you finally see Charlesworth.
I thought the length of this film was one of its strengths, actually. I think, you know, if it had been stretched out to 80 minutes or beyond, I think it would have been really tiresome. As it stands, this is like an episode of Poirot, basically. You know, it's like you get straight in there, you learn who's who, there's a murder, and then there's a few red herrings and a bit of a, you know, a bit of a detective work, and then bosh, you know, it's all solved. And you're out there, and it's less than an hour. And I have to say, of all the films we've watched so far, I enjoyed this one the most.
Yeah,
I think
me too.
This is
I can't disagree.
Really good film. Really, really good little whodunit. Very obscure. I never heard of anyone who's in it. But I really, really enjoyed this film. I'd say this is my favourite Hammer so far.
Yeah, I can't disagree with that. And also, as you said, the runtime is really beneficial to it. Because it is a hop, skip, and a jump, isn't it? It's setting up the characters, it's having the murder, it's solving the murder. Bang, easy, done. Mm. And also, whereas, like, say, Sporting Love, I mean, we're going to keep referencing it just because it's so fresh in our minds and because, well, us three sensible people hated it. we won't talk about what the other one thought about it. But
who?
But I know who. Yeah. But he's some kind of secretary. I don't know. But whereas that over multiple viewings just in my mind got worse and worse, this got better and better. Mm. And I did not dread putting this on again. Let me put it that way.
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
You know, and I was more than happy to rent it from the BFI. I was more than happy to give them my money to watch this. I thought it was a highly entertaining whodunit that doesn't outstay its welcome. Mm. What's wrong with that? You know,
yeah. The BFI have definitely got a spike over the last couple of weeks because we've been renting it on a regular basis.
Yeah, all of us left, right, and center have been giving them money to watch this.
I think it definitely has issues. Like
it's not perfect.
The acting, I would say, like this reminded, right, the first time I tried to watch this film is quite late. And I thought, why should I put it on? It's only like less than an hour. Should I put it on? I put it on. The first 10 minutes I was like, whoa, I'm just not digging this at all. The acting is very school play. It reminded me of a school play. Yeah. You know, no one acts in this film. They just say their lines to each other. It's like, you know, like there's no performance in any of it, apart from, of course, God, what's his name?
Don Stannard.
Don Stannard. There we go. The guy who not the lead. No, the guy that works in the shop.
Stephen Fry.
Cecil. Yeah, he's
Stephen Fry.
He's basically Stephen Fry. Yeah. Yes. Apart from him, everyone else in the film is just like completely nobody. But you know, he gives it a bit of welly. Even he's not great. But you know, like when you watch this film, I would say please stick with it because the first 10 minutes are very, very amateur hour, and because the production design is a bit drab, you kind of go, oh, really? Even though this is only 50 minutes, do I want to stick with this? But I would say stick with it because the heritage is there. I mean, Christiana Brand, one of the greatest golden age detective writers of all time, responsible for things like Green for Danger and the Nurse Matilda books, which became Nanny McPhee. She's a great, great writer. And, you know, Smokey will have filled you in on why she's so amazing by now.
Oh, yes.
But, yeah, she never puts a foot wrong when it comes to writing. And this adaptation is very neat, swift, quick, efficient, quite clever, quite witty adaptation with a lovely twist. And I do think it's badly cast, and I don't think the actors are particularly the best, but you will be sucked in by the story. I really, really, really dug this. I think it's really good.
Yeah.
And I can't wait to watch it again, actually.
Yeah. Nice. I did like the interplay between Don Stannard, that's Detective Charlesworth, and Elsa T, I think her name is, who plays Miss Victoria. They've got a few scenes together, and they're quite entertaining, you know, because obviously there's some subtext going on, which you really do pick up when you watch it again. Obviously, the first time, you're unsure of what's going on, but on the second viewing, it just becomes so apparent, and it's that, brilliant to watch.
It's very clever, because when I got to the end the first time, I was like, what? Like, that final scene, I was like, what? That's so clever. Like, and as well, that really didn't need to be there, but because it's there, it just makes you, it just makes you end with a bit of a fizz, you know, because you go, ooh, like that. And then I watched it the second time, and I completely saw a completely different story because of that final scene. So yeah, really, like, very clever, very, very clever, really fun, really fun.
I mean, obviously, without spoiling it, that the end of the film is basically the detective going through a reason why anyone had a chance or motive to commit the crime. And even though even on the second viewing, when I knew who had done the killing, I'm there going, oh yeah, he's right, that person could have done it as well. And it's like, well, hang on, no, but I know they didn't. It was like, oh yeah, it was as you say, it's incredibly clever, and it took me by surprise. And it shouldn't do. I mean, with the source material, and they obviously knew what they were doing. I actually know. I'm going to have to disagree with you a little bit there, Adam. I think you'd be a little. I don't think severely miscast. I think with what they're given and the characters out, I think the actors all did it pretty well. I've got no problem with any of the performances.
I think for me, Kenneth Warrington, who plays Mr. Bevan, the lead, you know, the owner of Christoph's.
All right, I'll give you that one. So problematic.
He looks like I think we had a chat last night, and I described him as a Burnley City Council member. He is rather rotund. He has no hair. He's the least charming person in the world. Yet you're supposed to believe that all these fashion models are kind of like, now he's mine. Now he's mine. Now he's mine. I'll kill you. It's like, really? God, I wish I'd been alive back then. I'm no oil painting or anything. I could have strolled through that thing and just had them, you know, beaten them off.
It's kind of like Rene Artois, isn't it? Getting all the hot barmaids from the cafe. Yeah.
He's like Rene Fartois. That's the problem with him. he's like a badly molded Toby jug, and you just don't really buy that thing, you know. But yeah, I mean, that you can't say that wasn't miscast. I'll tell you what.
Fair enough.
My favourite character though has to be the char lady, the lady.
Yeah.
Mrs. Harris.
Oh my God.
Mrs. Harris.
I can't wait to threaten someone now and say, I'll slosh you. Slosh. What a great word.
Yeah. No, I've got to agree. She was my favourite character right from the off. When she sort of offers her credentials as to why she shouldn't be messed with. And it's because I'm a mother and I'm from this part of London and no one messes with us round here. And it was like, yeah, fair dues. I won't mess with you at all.
You know, she's credited on the IMDb page as Mrs. Harris. A-R-R-I-S.
Yeah.
And it's like, yes. I'm sure that's supposed to be Harris, but she's pronounced it Harris. But someone's gone, oh, it must be Harris then.
Well, it's Cockney rhyming slang, isn't it, in Harris? So it's
for your backside.
Oh yeah,
I don't whether that has any connotations towards the film or the character, I do not know. I couldn't say.
I shouldn't think it has. But...
Nope, none whatsoever. I was just leaving it in there as a bit of intrigue.
For me, Diana Wong as Miss Almond Blossom, she's got some brilliant lines throughout. She's got this standing joke where whatever it is, she'll just go, that's sacred in my culture, you know, and you think, you're just making all sorts of crap up here, aren't you? But there's a great line when the detectives go around to her flat, which we'll talk about. The decor of her flat is crazy.
She has an altar.
She says about... yeah. She says that...
and she has
a murder
a
for sunshine.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yeah, and a little gold statue of Buddha.
She has a counter.
Which she prays to figure out the who done it at one point.
Apparently.
Like, what? Yeah, but I like the line where she said, a murder for sunshine. That's something new. I thought that was great.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, I hadn't really thought about it that way. But yeah, but I thought she was good. I thought she was great. You know,
yeah.
I actually thought she was going to stab herself while she was praying. I believed her.
That looked pretty insane. It looked like she
Didn't
was... It? Yeah, yeah. I also liked the look of the Pontefract pub. I've got to put this in here, there, because they'd got port on the window at 1 and 6, a glass, which is great.
Yeah. Kev, you know all about that kind of money, don't you?
I'm still using it.
Yeah, as soon as I saw that sign in the window, I was like, yeah, this is a pub for Kev.
Listen to him mention definitely. This on the round table.
1 6, right.
That's Aldi prices.
Well, you wish.
Now you're talking.
Yeah. Something I mentioned, as you said, Adam, we had a brief chat about this last night, and something I mentioned to Kev, because I know he's a fan, is wouldn't it have just been wonderful if in that final scene, when the detective is interrogating everyone to find out who the killer is, that if we got a Beast Must Die style werewolf break and they line everyone up and just say, do you think it's this person? Do you think it's this person? And I thought that would have been awesome.
Yeah, that would have been quite good, actually.
Yeah, just add an extra 5 minutes onto the film and just have this really terrible horror voiceover going, who do you think is the killer? Just run a bit. I thought it would have been fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, you could have got Detective Charlesworth to do a voiceover again.
It actually would have worked as well. This film is very self-aware. I think it's, you know, it's kind of all a wink and a nudge. But I think that sort of plays to the amateurishness of it. I think this film could have benefited from a big name. Like I said last night, I think put a not a massive name, like a Sally Gray or a Leo Genn or just an Alastair Sim, something like that. Just, you know, if you'd had a name in there, this film could have done bonanza box office. As it was, I think they just cast it with, you know, the cheapest people they could find. I don't think it particularly. You know, there's no standouts in the cast. I mean, I did like Mrs. Harris. Thought she was very fun, but you know, you can tell she never went on to anything else. I think it. Like, I got to the end, and I had actually kind of fallen for everyone. I just think this film deserves to have done a lot better, and I think it could have done if they'd had a bit more of a name in it. I'm really like sad they didn't splash out a bit of cash and just put a name in there that perhaps could have turned up on a box set. But it seems like this film is destined to like be forgotten unless people like us dredge it up and go, look, this is actually a really good movie, because it doesn't have any, you know, star power to it at all, which I think is a real shame, because it's a real gem. I really liked this film, really liked it.
I agree. Mm. I think it definitely deserves to be known more. I mean, this was well out of my wheelhouse. I'd never heard of it until I knew what we were reviewing this time. But yeah, I mean, it's going to be one that I heartily recommend from now on, because it deserves more recognition, I think.
Mm. Did anyone else find that Mr. Bevan scene towards the end, like, really out of place, though? Like, so basically what happens is the policeman who, you know, does that Golden Age detective thing of gathering the suspects in a room and sort of runs by what's happened and sort of says, yes, but you had a reason to do this, didn't you? And then they come out with the secret that they've been hiding for all this time, you know, I have a mother and she's in this room. I have a daughter and she's in this room, blah, blah, blah. So it gets to Mr. Bevan and they make, the policeman makes mention of the fact that, you know, he's had a lot of lady friends. Which is more, you know, it's more fantastical to believe than when you see the guy. Yes. Yeah, it's crazy. But he comes out with this like really oddly out of place kind of uncharacteristic. He turns from being this kind of, oh, I'm very smooth, into this, yeah, you know what women are? They're all right. I won't repeat what he says, but basically, he just turns, he says this horribly sexist, horribly misogynist kind of like diatribe. Like, and everyone just sort of shrinks back against the wall as he's saying it. He goes, well, this guy definitely did it. And then he just stops, he stops at the end and goes, but I didn't kill her. And they all go, well, okay then. So, come on. Even if he didn't kill her, I would still hang him.
The thing is, who's going to turn up for work the following morning after that?
Yeah. Yeah, it'd be very awkward.
I mean, toxic work environment from now on, isn't it?
Yeah.
Hi. Yeah. You know, yesterday when we were all saying stuff we didn't mean.
Hey, do you remember that time you accidentally let slip what a misogynist pig you are? Let's do a fashion show.
Please put this.
Let's paint our feet.
Yes.
Yeah, it did feel a little out of place, I'll grant you that. But no, as I said, that was just a bit that I really, really enjoyed, because it just came out of nowhere that everyone had a secret, but none of their secrets were they actually killed someone. So it's like, all right, fair enough. We'll hear all these random bits about your private life that no one should ever find out about you, but all right, fair dues.
I think the film was very surreptitious in the way that it delivered as well, because I think it was like a very cheap-looking B-movie. As I say, with no stars, and performances aren't like particularly magnetic. But by the end of the film, I knew who everyone was. I actually cared about more than half the cast, have to say, and was genuinely intrigued as to what happened to them afterwards. And that doesn't happen very often, especially with little B-movies like this, especially 50 minutes. I genuinely thought, I really wish this had like 5 or 6 sequels, because I'd love to know what happened to Mrs. Harris, and I'd love to know what happened. You know, I'd love to see the inspector in more adventures. I'd even like a prison film with the eventual perpetrator, which I won't give away. I'd like to see a prison film with that person in it. Yeah, it was cool. And I'd like to see Miss Almondblossom as well, you know, going off and being a spy somewhere.
I'd like to see another film with Sergeant Bed, you know, where he's learning yet another language. I've not even mentioned him. Detective Charlesworth's sidekick, who speaks fluent Latin and French and Italian and Spanish. He's just all over the place.
He's great. And
brilliant.
As a snapshot of like late 40s England as well, I actually really dug it. Like, you know, the shots of the high street and the fashions and all, you know, and the fact that, you know, they all eat lunch in the basement downstairs. It's rather really intriguing. And like, you know, just the bits where they're like, you know, going around. I love all these like the slice of life parts, which show you, you know, the kind of the way that people's flats looked in those days. And it's very personal to me, obviously. I'm not saying this is why the film works, but I just find it really adorable to see fireplaces in 1940 and, you know, the way people were driving and stuff, and just the kind of shops on the high street. If you want to like a snapshot of like post-war Britain, it's a really good one.
And who knew London had so many chemists? There's one on every corner.
He's pounding that beef for hours.
Oh no.
Oh, no.
Yeah, because he goes, right, we're going to have a busy half an hour. And it's like, no, mate, you're going to have a busy 10 hours.
I've got to go to every chemist now to see who bought poison. He's in and out, up the steps, down the stairs. Poor guy.
I mean, yeah, it's some job he didn't go around at dinner time, isn't it? Because everywhere closes for lunch and they all go down into the basement to make curry.
I know. Yeah, that's... Excuse me, I demand a fashion show. Where are you all? Hello? Show me some knickers.
But no, I can see that. It does show you kind of that, a good snapshot of London in the 40s. I like that. It was good. There was nothing that I really disliked about this film. You know, it was just a very pleasant ride for 46 minutes. You know, it was just... Yeah.
Absolutely,
I can't knock it.
One of the
it was
one
certainly
of the great,
not hoo-ha.
No. Oh, my God. What? What a great line
the
of dialogue.
Greatest, the greatest line of dialogue in cinematic history.
It really is. And it was in this film. Who knew?
Yeah.
Kev, tell us what it was.
Well, did you say something like, God, I'm like, I put it down the hoo-ha.
The hoo-ha. What did you do with it? I put it down the hoo-ha.
And what?
Just looking down the hoo-ha.
I put it down the hoo-ha.
I put it down the hoo-ha.
And the policeman says, what do you mean? He's, you know, the toilet.
The toilet. Like,
well, I'm just genius.
You know, yeah, he's just so posh that he doesn't like saying the word toilet.
The hoo-ha.
He's Stephen Fry, after all.
It's true.
It means so many things.
Yeah.
There's another film from this period called Green for Danger, also written based on a book by Christiana Brand, starring Alistair Sim, Leo Genn, Sally Gray, all the great sort of, you know, big British actors, Trevor Howard. That is one of the greatest whodunits ever put onto film. It's very, very clever. And all the clues are on the film. It's one of those films that you watch, and if you really pay attention, you can work out who's done it and how, but you really have to pay attention. It's ultra, ultra clever. It's really, really good. You should definitely check it out. If this film had had those production values and those stars, I think it would be way more remembered than it is these days. I'm really sorry it isn't. Mm. It definitely deserves a better legacy than it currently has.
Well, yeah. we're helping to right that wrong. Mm,
let's do that.
Yeah, I'm glad that the BFI player actually has it, and it's a good copy of it as well. You know, it's decent print.
It is. Oh yeah, I thought the quality was fine. I could hear it all perfectly. Yeah. Could see it all perfectly. All good.
Mm. Yep.
Yeah. It's just a shame, I guess, that it's not more readily available.
Yeah. Yeah. It needs to be out. It needs to be out there more.
Mm.
Mm.
Definitely worth. Yeah. Your time.
I think that's a good place to stop it then. Definitely worth your time. It's well worth seeking out.
Yeah. Hard recommend from me. Definitely.
Very much
yeah,
so, yeah.
Same
I,
here.
I can't disagree. Yeah. If you have any desire to check it out, and if you actually listen to us and actually trust what we say, then yeah, it's a very high recommend for me. This is the best Hammer film so far.
Me too. I'd have to say as well, the whole film is probably shorter than this episode is going to be.
Mercifully.
Well, that's the closets in room 4 rifled through good and proper. Hope you can join us again when we discover what lies behind the door of room 5. If you've enjoyed this episode, be sure to subscribe and give us a nice rating on your podcatcher of choice. If you want to follow us or get in touch, we're on Twitter and Instagram as @HouseHammerPod. You could also shock us to the very core by sending an email via scream@houseofhammerpodcast.com. So, from me, Kev Moore.
From me, Adam Roach.
From me, Ben Tillerson.
From me, Smokey.
We wish you all well and look forward to seeing you again in the House of Hammer.